Hello and welcome to the Tech and Trees podcast. My name is Pascal Mies, and on Tech and Trees, I talk to climate tech founders, investors, and operators to find out how we build better climate tech companies and how we build more of them faster. On this episode, I talk to George Darra, a principal at the climate tech VC Systemic Capital. George has a past in the mining and oil industry before he started building and investing in climate tech startups. So I talked to him about the mindset at oil companies and what it takes to change them, as well as what companies we should be building today to clean up the damage they have done. Like some other people on this podcast, George suggests that we should be more open to geoengineering solutions. So there's definitely food for thought here. Personally, I like it when we can talk about controversial topics, and I hope you do too. Enjoy.
Welcome to Tech and Trees.
Hey, George. Thank you so much for being here. How are you doing today?
Yeah, good. Excited to be here. Enjoying the extremely dry weather in the UK after the, 6 months of record-breaking rain. We've all been weather watchers, even more so than usual in the last few months.
Getting a peek at the sun once in a while. That's great to hear. I'd like to get to know you a bit better first before we dive into the more interesting questions later on. So I'd like to know... do you have a literary or movie character that you identify with for some reason?
Yeah, and I'm going to cheat a little bit on this because it's actually a character who was alive at one point. And it's one of my favorite books of the last 12 months or so, a book called Endurance by an author who was writing about Shackleton and his incredible expedition to the Antarctic, where he survived over a year on ice. And it's a funny book because you can read it as an adventurer, but also it's the most incredible business book as well. And the way to lead and build and inspire and continue grinding it out, even when the odds are so insanely stacked against you. So my brother has just been in South Georgia recently, where Shackleton did his final act, which was clambering over some extraordinary mountains with pretty much a sealskin smock on his back and some fur boots. And I'm always reminded that we are capable of so much. And it's very humbling to read these kind of stories.
Yeah, I recently read some polar exploration stories as well and really loved them. I also love that you're comparing yourself to one of the most famous polar explorers out there.
I'm not comparing myself. I merely say I was inspired.
Yeah, fair enough. What's the last aha moment you have had?
Look, we all came back into the office in the last week or so. And the first thing that we were talking about was aerosols. And aerosols are important because they're a way in which the atmosphere regulates heat. And one of the big things that happened last year was that sulfur was banned as a component of marine fuel. And what we've seen, we have one data point, but what we've seen is that temperatures globally have jumped significantly after this ban because there is less sulfur in the air, reflecting back sunlight effectively. And so we're all thinking about stratospheric aerosol injection, which is where you put some sort of aerosol, whether that's sulfur or otherwise, into the high atmosphere to reflect more sunlight than is currently being reflected, and effectively either stabilize or reduce global temperatures. And I think if you've read the Ministry of the Future, which is almost practically the handbook on how to solve climate change, you remember the Indian government unilaterally decides to start injecting sulfur dioxide, just sulfur up into the atmosphere. And that's always been a bit of a scary thing. Acid, we all remember acid rain. Apparently it's not actually that bad because the concentration is so little, but there are issues with sulfur around its acidity. Being one of them, and the fact that it is typically present when you're injecting it as a liquid, and so it globs together and is less effective. Recently, a guy called Nephew Jonathan published a blog post that said, well, if you just grind down limestone into nanoparticles and use that instead, that works, and you can do this for $5 billion a year, putting up hydrogen balloons and just basically like using little propellers to spread it into the atmosphere above the tropics, we can stabilize and reduce global temperatures to early 20th century levels. And so that was something that I think was all on our minds, is that we have such a strange aversion to engineering our climate on the positive, yet we are very happy to engineer to the negative and have been engineering to the negative for hundreds of years through the burning of fossil fuels and other sources of carbon. So it actually felt quite positive that if we could get behind something like this that doesn't cost very much money, we could really, you know, have a significant impact on our planet's habitability while we reduce the amount of fossil fuels that's going up at the moment.
Yeah, it's funny that you mentioned that. That's first of all a really great insight, actually. I was recently talking to another climate investor, Yuan Bernot from Clementum Capital, also on this podcast, and he also said that he thinks that it is sort of an unjustified stigma on geoengineering, sort of like pointing to the same reasoning that you just used in terms of, okay, we're happy to engineer stuff that, well, kind of harms our environment, harms our ability to live on this planet, but then we're not like looking enough into engineering solutions to reverse these kind of impacts or protect ourselves. And I think, I mean, there are obviously also reasons why there is a lot of controversial thought around geoengineering, right? And rightly so, but we should not just put a ban on it at all. Before we dive more into your actual expertise, I would like to ask you, what's a ridiculous problem you would like to see solved? And please, please don't answer climate change.
good question. I would like trains to be on time. I think that is probably my ridiculous problem that I face most days, is what would it take for someone to wake up and be like, my one reason to be is to create public transport that works and is on time. And I think it would deliver immense well-being to particularly the population of London. So that's very, perhaps very practical, but is extremely topical at the moment.
Oh, yeah, no, but I would agree 100%. Being from Germany and the German trains being very famous for not being on time, being very badly managed, that very much resonates with me. Let's get to what you're doing, and actually more specifically to what you've been doing in the past, because, you know, there are people like me who kind of got into climate change and startups like right out of university, and has kind of been an en vogue topic basically for all of my life. But I've never like worked, for example, in the oil industry that my generation likes to bash against, for example, but none of us have ever, you know, actually been in an oil firm or like know how they operate. You, however, have actually some experience in the oil and gas industry. And so I would like to talk to you about that. And first of all, I'd like to know, you know, how's the topic of climate change treated internally at the firms where you've been, like BP and Rio Tinto? Because I think it's not necessarily useful to just antagonize them out of the blue, but rather understand, like, you know, how do these firms work on the inside?
Yeah, good question. And firstly, to say it was a while since I was there, but many of the things remain quite similar. I think the topic of climate change per se is one that is seriously considered, and seriously considered because there is a material financial impact upon these companies of climate change. And that is both through the regulatory side and the physical side, i.e. like the risk to physical assets because of a changing climate. And so it's very much a risk-based conversation. These firms are very different, though, in that they sell to very different markets, and both are similarly incentivized to reduce their emissions in their direct operations for regulatory, perhaps even reputational reasons. But their end business models, or the scope three, i.e. like what the product actually does to the climate, is so different. And climate change and the policy outcomes from climate change, which have been supporting renewables and attempting to stop subsidizing fossil, is an incredible opportunity for the likes of Rio Tinto and other mining companies, because renewables is so metals heavy per gigawatt of installed capacity. Whereas for BP, it's an existential question, because it's their product poisons the atmosphere. I mean, there's no other way of saying it. It's incredibly convenient. It's it's powered our economies for the last 150 years or so. But they have a very different existential question to answer. Whereas Rio Tinto are looking at this thinking, fantastic. This is going to be us for the next 100 years or so.
Yeah, interesting comparison. What is it like for the people on the inside of these firms, right? Like I'll talk to you later about, like what you've been doing there specifically. But overall, like, I mean, if you know, okay, A, my firm or the firm that I'm working for, my employer, is being antagonized out in the open most of the time by a lot of people. But B, there is also really like a lot of existential risk to my employer and therefore my, own kind of existence.
Yeah. It's interesting. I mean, you either ignore it and crack on with your job, which I think most of us are interested to a degree in stability and comfort and taking home a paycheck. And that is common to all companies. And then there is another section, which is how do we create a movement within or momentum within the company that pushes it towards a better climate orientated business model. And I think that kind of thing is really interesting because so many people have gone into these big organizations with an ambition to change and a sense of purpose that really is around how do I influence this big organization? And if I can, that is a significant thing. And I think that can work. When you have something like BP, though, it's hard because you, as a director of that organization, have a fiduciary duty to allocate capital into the most financially rewarding outcomes. And oil and gas is much more financially rewarding. It has been for the last however long and is likely to continue to be than investing into renewables. And so these companies are, despite this exciting and I think it has been a compelling narrative of the reallocation of CapEx from oil and gas to renewables, it's a really hard thing to do because of the return profile of renewables, because of the cost base of these companies. They have incredibly generous salaries, pension schemes, and the fact that their shareholders expect massive dividends and their share price will be hammered if they don't. So it's a real bind that the industry is in, particularly the publicly traded international oil companies that we know so well. And I've struggled, particularly as I've thought about this more and seen the retracting of climate commitments over the last year or so from many of those common household names, to see whether this industry truly can lead. I think it can follow begrudgingly, but whether it can lead, I've struggled to see that.
Yeah, sort of a perfect example for path dependencies overall, that you cannot just, or like for how difficult it is to turn such a huge ship as a BP, for example, around. And that it's kind of like also an example for why startups are maybe more suited to make some sort of dent in the whole sustainability world. But I think when, we are in the kind of green bubble that we are in, it's easy to rave about startups and the impact potential and so on and so forth, right? But like I don't see any startup in the world that will probably ever get as big as ABP, for example, right? Or at least like give it maybe another 50 years and then. But, the trajectory is just completely different. And I think it's easy to neglect that we also need to work with these kind of big companies that are out there that have a massive impact on the world.
I think helping these companies reduce their emissions is a good thing. But I think we are naive if we believe that BP will become a renewables company in any sort of timeline that we need to avoid catastrophic heating. And therefore the companies who are pure play renewables have to do renewables, do not have a get out of jail free card where they can say, well, renewables isn't really that working for us, we're going to just flip back to oil and gas. That option has to be taken away if you want to truly build a world-class, world-leading renewables business.
Yeah. So what do you think, like, telling from, working at BP, but also you're now outside of you on the industry, like, what are the what is a realistic way of dealing with these firms, or like, you know, talking about them in societal discourse, and what are, you know, actual drivers for change? Like what needs to happen?
Yeah. I think firstly, these firms are increasingly irrelevant in a global, like the global oil landscape. Like it's the NOCs, the national oil companies, who are producing the vast majority of oil. So that's the first just contextualizing piece. And then I do think that you need a different business, like the likes of Ørsted, which, although they're struggling at the moment just because of the downturn in renewables, is you have to separate the renewables business from the legacy oil and gas business, because the return profile, the cost base, the risk, it's all just so different. And that, I think, is very hard to rapidly and effectively birth a renewables business within an oil and gas company.
Okay, so you're saying they should spin, or if they have any plans on renewables, then they should spin off these kind of divisions. On your LinkedIn profile, you state that while you were BP, you kind of built the equivalent to Dumbledore's army. Yeah. at BP. Do you mind double clicking on that? Yeah, because we're also talking about, you know, drivers of change from within these companies.
Yeah. Well, I had the privilege of working for some really extraordinary people while I was there. And I did five different jobs in 4 years and moved all over the place. And one of these extraordinary leaders who I worked for was a man named Mike Leonard. And he was a fantastic source of encouragement to go and try things. Stop talking, go and do something. And one of the things we wanted to do was bring together a group of people in BP who are dissatisfied with the way in which innovation was currently running and being done through, you know, extraordinary numbers of feasibility studies, etc., and work out ways where you could do things that were relatively low risk, very low cost, but could have significant positive impact. So we brought together a group of people within BP who were just excited by this. And it was catalyzed by a guy I actually sat next to who has gone on to start a company called Gravity Industries, which is he is effectively like Iron Man. He's built a suit with gas turbines that allows him to fly around. And he was very much part of the inspiration as well. And we just tried lots of different things. We had Fitbits coming in where we were working out whether they would help BP shipping understand whether their operators were fit, you know, were rested enough, were fit to work. I had engineers from in South Africa. We were looking at whether we could introduce solar facilities to help reduce LPG use on a refinery. All sorts of great things, and it was a real, I think it was a vent for many people who felt like, suddenly we have something where people are, they're still part of this big company, but they want to do something differently. And it was a really, it was a very exciting time.
Yeah, no, it sounds like it. I'd like to know, you know, as we're talking about like everything that needs to happen around these kind of big firms, and you were already saying, you know, it needs, or there are great opportunities for startups to make a dent. What kind of opportunities do you see for startups when relating to the oil and gas sector, for example, but also adjacent industries?
Yeah, I think methane is probably the big thing, that there is an immediate potential for having very significant climate impacts. If we can measure and stop fugitive methane emissions from the entirety of the oil and gas sector, it would be a very material thing. And so one of the things I do is, with my investor hat on, is spending much time looking for companies who are able to cost effectively measure with high degree of granularity methane releases across oil and gas facilities, but also more broadly old coal mines, even agriculture, rice farming. It's a very significant source of methane. So I think that is one of the areas where I believe there is a really big and immediate need where technology companies can come in.
What's your take on methane removal overall? Because, you know, there's a somewhat nascent carbon removal sector, right? But methane removal, I think there are some papers around it, right, which are interesting. I haven't really seen companies in the space yet for different reasons, but like I would like to hear your take.
carbon removal is difficult enough as it is from air because of the extremely low concentration of CO2. Methane is order of magnitude plus lower than that. And so the energy required to remove a ton of methane from the atmosphere is extraordinary. I don't have the numbers to hand myself for methane, but for carbon dioxide, it's around typically like two plus megawatt hours per ton of CO2 removed from the atmosphere. These are massive numbers. I mean, it's a really, really energy intensive thing. One of the things that's not spoken about often is that there is a significant opportunity cost with allocating that electricity to very, very power hungry DAC versus other things like decarbonization of existing processes or electrification of existing processes. We need to scale DAC, or let's not say DAC, let's say CDR, because I think there are much more effective ways of removing carbon from the atmosphere and from the sea. But we also need to recognize that every dollar we spend on methane removal is a dollar we're not spending on abating steel or cement, for example. So I would be quite skeptical of a methane removal startup that was looking at a direct air capture style model. But there are companies looking at points, almost more concentrated sources of methane that I think are really, really interesting, particularly around agriculture.
Okay, so looking for the low-hanging fruit and making sure to have the right field of application. Yeah, makes a lot of sense. You were just talking, or you already mentioned your investor hat, and I think I'll take that to segue into, you know, your job today. You're an investor at venture capital fund Systemic, where you focus on climate solutions. And on your profile basically says that you're looking to invest in founders who are building the new economy. Could you just expand on that? Like, what's your understanding at Systemic of the new economy?
So the whole reason we exist is to accelerate the transition to a net zero and nature positive economy. And so our investing is never outside of an economic context. And Systemic, which is our originating organization, was set up in 2016 or so to do just that, to look very systematically at what are the big levers to pull in the big systems that emit millions, hundreds of millions, even billions of tons of CO2, the material system, the energy system, the food and land use system. And the investment practice grew out of that. We're now a separate VC fund, Systemic Capital, and we have all of the benefits of great relationships and connectivity into Systemic, but we are, to all intents and purposes, an independent VC. And so that DNA is very much at the core of us. Like, we look at the climate problem as a industrial transition problem and as a efficiency problem and as a introduction of new technologies problem. And really we're not investing into something that sits outside of capitalism or any of these things. It's got to be bedded into building big businesses, because the only way you're going to have big impact is if you build a really big business. And we want to be investing into the big businesses of tomorrow that have massive positive outcomes for climate and nature.
Yeah, makes sense. I like how you view climate change as a problem of an industrial transition overall. I was talking to Hampus from Pale Blue Dot about this, and we're kind of like differentiating between idealistic entrepreneurship that is just driven by morality, basically, and just pragmatic entrepreneurship in the climate space, right? That is just about, there are so many better ways to, for example, power society that is not harming our society, right? So we're also like looking at this more from the economic point of view, and I think this very much fits the bill. So I like that a lot. You were saying now that you're looking for businesses that can really grow into, well, massive firms, right? Because that's the only way for impact. And I'd like to know, you know, what kind of, because you're investing in Series Seed and Series A, right? So I'd like kind of to know, what are the proof points that you're looking for at these startups so that kind of show that this firm can scale?
Yeah.
And feel free to also give examples from different industries. Yeah. I know that this is kind of a very broad question.
I think first and foremost, it's that the founder has a track record of execution and commerciality. And these are really important because often climate tech, it attracts a very mission-driven set of founders, which is fantastic. And that is something we always need to be convinced of. But there is a subset of those founders who are, you know, exceptional executors and exceptionally commercial. And those things are really important to us because, again, you will never have impact if you can't build a very big profitable business ultimately. And so the way we look at those track records, the questions we ask is really around what are those commercial proof points? Have they built something? Have they sold something? Are they speaking about customers and a problem rather than a dream of some sort of climate outcome, first and foremost? That climate outcome is really important, but it's not important at all if the business doesn't solve an acute problem for a customer, first and foremost. So I love it when I will be having a conversation with another exceptional entrepreneur and they will say, we've spent 6 months speaking to every potential customer of this solution, and this is the problem. And this is why we're building this. And this would be the climate outcome. And that is such a compelling entry point to, oh, this is a company that really wants to sell something. Because that's fundamentally the only reason a company exists, is if they're able to sell something.
Yeah. So you're saying people or entrepreneurs do not only need to be able to, you know, have a grand vision, but actually, you know, that vision should originate from a track record of execution, as you put it, right? Yeah, makes sense. I'd like to know a bit more about how you work with founders in your portfolio, maybe. And I'd like to, you know, sometimes I think it's a bit arbitrary when I hear from friends or people I'm somewhat in touch with, like when they start raising or how they talk about the difference between a, you know, seed stage startup and a Series A startup. So what kind of frameworks or markers are there for founders to assess whether they should be raising a Series A? You know, like at what point can you actually say, okay, we have reached a product market fit, we are ready to scale? You know, like how do you work with your founders on assessing this kind of question?
I think there's the cynical view, which is, well, we have 12 months runway left, so we need to raise some more money, which is a viable reason. The other is you have hit all your milestones early, which is fantastic. And I think these are really hard. I don't really use very specific detailed frameworks because I just don't think they're that useful. And I think you can end up trying to shoehorn in companies, founders into things that just don't really make sense because every company is different, but climate tech especially is not a business model. It's not even a sector. It's an outcome. It's a set of businesses that through the sale of their product deliver a climate outcome. And that product can be something all the way from CO2, captured CO2, through to physical risk analytics. So it's like to have a climate tech framework for assessing is nearly impossible, which is part of why this job is very hard, because you have to be very flexible across multiple business models, multiple technologies, and multiple geographies to be able to assess whether this is actually going to work or not. And I think that's part of the reason why we felt so strongly that building and maintaining a strong relationship with Systemic was such a big part of us being able to be a climate generalist and be able to operate across these very, very different sectors of the food and ag sector, the materials sector, the hard to abate steel, cement, chemicals, the finance sector. These are all very, very different spaces. And when you're an outcome-based investor, which climate tech is, you need to have all the help you can get to understand technologies and business models across those very diverse sectors.
Yeah, makes sense. I'd like to know, as you said now, that climate tech is not necessarily a sector. It's more, you know, like a sum of businesses that deliver a climate outcome by selling a certain product, right? Like, how do you at Systemic Capital look at or like define what businesses are in scope for you and which are not? Like, you know, it's kind of like this debate of indirect and direct climate impact. Sometimes it's very easy to say for a tech company, for example, okay, they draw down tons of CO2, they charge a certain price, fine. You know, that's very easy to categorize. What about indirect or enabling technologies, you know?
Yeah, I think even for a DAC company, like it's actually not straightforward because again, you have the opportunity cost of where would that electricity have been used otherwise, and what is the embodied like energy in the there's all these things that mean that I think that CO2 abated is important as a metric amongst others, but is very simplistic if you have it as the single metric. We don't use anything as our halo screening tool. We use a complex number of them based upon the specific sector. And often that will be informed by lots of the work that Systemic has done. And so it's very important for us to be able to reflect deeply on what are the climate impacts, but what are also the biodiversity impacts? What are even the social impacts of this? And I think that kind of like system understanding really only comes when you have a bigger set of relationships, connections, even a think tank like Systemic has to help us understand that. So we typically don't have a very simple sheet of like these are the five things, but it like roughly CO2 impact always needs to be approximately in the kind of hundreds of millions, 500 million sort of space. They need to be big industries. The TAM is often a good proxy for the CO2 abatement. So we typically wouldn't look at anything like under a $1 billion TAM. That would be at the very, very small side. And the impact needs to be material across a wide range of stakeholders. And so what I mean by that is that it can't just accrue to a government or a set of policy making institutions. It needs to be to customers who are buying this thing in the real world. One example of a company we've invested into is a company called Basecamp Research, who don't have a very strong climate impact story. There is no, this technology will abate hundreds of millions of dollars of CO2, but they have an incredibly strong biodiversity story because they are building a new way in which to value biodiversity for the genetic information it contains, rather than for the heat potential after we've burnt it, or the nutrition potential, which have been typically the ways in which we valued biodiversity previously.
Yeah, got it. We're talking about how you were working with your founders, or how you're working with your founders. And, you know, like, I mean, I checked your LinkedIn profile, obviously, and you have not always been an investor at Systemic, right? But you actually started building businesses for them, if that's the right way to put it. You can say more about that. And you have been to Nigeria and Indonesia for these kind of gigs, you know? Like, do you mind like telling me a bit more about what you were doing there, A? But B, also like how these experiences have shaped or are still shaping how you work with founders and startups today.
Yeah. Those were two quite wild experiences when Systemic was still at that wonderful phase of working out what it wanted to be when it grew up. And the Nigeria experience was really as almost employee number four at a digital energy startup run by another extraordinary entrepreneur who were trying to bring together every single way you could electrify a home under a single customer experience. So whether that was a solar home system or a mini grid or the grid. And so we spent a lot of time out in Nigeria working with the relative players. And I think that the real learnings from that is how hard it is to execute on the ground, particularly when you are trying to execute in a geography that isn't your home geography. The electricity business as well is very, very difficult, especially when you have high rates of theft, high rates of non-payment, which are all endemic to the Nigerian electricity system. And so I think it really gave me a sense of you need the right team, the right skills, and you need to select the right geography to nail your business model. That was very good fun, and I had some remarkable experiences driving through the Nigerian countryside in a seven car kind of security convoy and all sorts of ridiculous things like that. But it was a great experience. And so I decided to leave that company after 12 months and go to Indonesia with Systemic, where I joined another company, which was doing something quite different, where they had been given 40,000 hectares of rainforest to protect and restore, but also make money. This is quite an unusual land use designation that's relatively unique to Indonesia, where they are companies are given an ecosystem restoration designation, which means they still get taxed at full rate, but they also have to restore the land. So it's quite a hard thing to do. And my remit really was...
It doesn't sound fair to me.
Yeah, make money, but don't chop the rainforest down. And so it was, in many ways, it was a dream job. I was working in this extraordinary rainforest in the middle of Sumatra for a fully Indonesian company, heading up their commercial activities. Systemics office was in Jakarta at the time. So we were moving a lot between them. And again, I think anytime you interact with the physical world, things are just exponentially harder because there are so many things outside of your control that act to delay, frustrate, disrupt your activities. And often, again, I was so fortunate to work with some really exceptional people, but overall, realizing how important it was to have a core of people who knew how to execute. If you don't have that, you can't get anything done. And I think that was one of the frustrations that we had. And also just things like it rained and the road flooded. And so we couldn't go into the field. And then things got delayed by a month because we wanted to plant a vanilla plantation and we couldn't. And then the seedlings died and you had to get more seedlings and that took away. It just, these things are just extraordinary complex. I think it certainly gives me a degree of empathy that founders are not just building PowerPoints for the hell of it. It's a real, can be a distraction, but also it can be a way to focus the story. A VC is really just moving money from one place to another, and then helping those founders as much as you can in the trenches as much as you can once you've made that commitment. But it is not founding and running a company, and I think it's really important to be cognizant of that. And with my experiences, it's very, very hard.
I'd be interested, like, how much of a value add do you think is the empathy that you now have for an entrepreneur? You know what I mean? Like, because, like, you know, sometimes I see VCs or you see VCs posting about advice on company building and so on that they might base on their operating experience from like 20 years ago, right? And I'm always wondering, okay, how relevant is this experience? I often think to myself, well, isn't there, you know, ability to put themselves in the founder's shoes much more valuable than, you know, their actual operational experience?
Yeah, I think there are some things that building a company, just like there are a set of activities that every entrepreneur and every founder will do. For me, it's having empathy and humility, I think, is the most important thing. And that being able to turn up and listen and recognize that, again, that I'm not running the team. I'm not running the company. I haven't founded and built a company. I'm here to help them do their job. And whether that's through financing, but also through the connectivity of Systemic, the introductions to corporates, to other financiers, to other opportunities in the policy space, that's what we can do really, really well. And being very open and transparent about that and about what we don't do so well, I think is really important. It just helps that conversation flow much, much more quickly. And the real privilege of the role is where those relationships are deeply long-term, enduring, trusted, which allows you to have just the most extraordinary impact in when things are tough and when your founders think, which investor can I go to with this very difficult thing? Who will actually listen and try to understand rather than panic? And that is the type of investor I want to be.
Yeah. You've been an investor now for 3 years, right? Approximately, something like that. And you've mentioned now several times that you were very fortunate to work with exceptional people, right? And so I wonder a bit, like, who were the founders and companies, or people for that matter, who have left like the deepest impression on you, and mm-hmm. why so?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a few come very immediately to mind. I think one company who we've been with for a long time now, we were the first institutional capital in, is a company called Nature Metrics. And Kat Bruce, who is the founder, and Katie was the CEO at the time, and now, you know, we have this incredible new CEO too called Dimple, have all been really remarkable in their grit, their passion, their depth in the Nature data space. And that company has grown from when Kat did her PhD back in 2017 or whenever it was, to now being the market leader in that space. And to have played a part in that journey has been a real privilege, and to have seen them grow. The next company comes to mind is Hoxton Farms, Ed and Max. Again, just an incredible partnership. It's very rare to meet two founders who have known each other since kindergarten, and two founders who have such deeply complementary skill sets. Max is a biologist and Ed is a mathematician, blending them to do something quite extraordinary for the alternative protein sector. And then similarly, another co-founding team, Ed, Glenn and Ollie at Basecamp, who built their company, basically built the idea for their company from a tent on a glacier in Iceland, where they did some of the world's first remote in situ sequencing of DNA found in the ice outside their tent. And these kind of stories are just, it's wonderful to be a small part of those journeys, and to roll up sleeves, get in, be part of the highs and lows, not to panic, to be there for the long term. Is a real privilege.
These people sound like some wild people. Interesting, very, very interesting.
I mean, those are the people that we want to partner with.
Thank you so much for those insights. I'd slowly but surely like to come to the end and maybe even circle a bit back to the beginning. And we're talking a lot about the infrastructure that powers the world, and I'm thinking a lot about that these days, because ultimately that's maybe the biggest problem that we have, that we're still so fossil fuel reliant, right? And for the foreseeable future, well, we will still be reliant on fossil fuels. Do you have a thesis at Systemic? What kind of companies are needed to change that? Like what fields do we really need to double down on?
Yeah, we absolutely have like sectoral thesis. We do not have theses on this is the company that someone should build, because we do not know that as well as the entrepreneurs. If we did, we'd be starting those companies. The areas though that are so important to build a new economy in particular, that come to mind, the first one is the chemicals industry. I think it's been extremely underserved in the past by innovation, in part because of, again, the capex required to get into it, and the legacy industry that's there. But this is an industry responsible for, I don't know what it is, I think it's like 3 billion tons of CO2 per year. It's about three to five trillion of kind of TAM. I mean, like, it's an enormous industry, and it's probably going to be the last industry to fully decarbonize, because it's just so hard. So companies in that space. There's a company called Radical Dot, which is being set up by two friends from Systemic right now to revolutionize the chemical recycling industry. And these kind of startups, I think, are really interesting, especially when they can get their capital structure right. Others like the cement industry, aviation, these hard to abate sectors are really where, when we see business model innovation or technology innovation in those spaces, it's very exciting. The last space I'd probably mention is HVAC, that we are busy installing, some successfully, some less successfully, heat pumps in Europe right now. But of course, there will be more AC required in developing countries as well. And the refrigerant used by HVAC is still not great. And if it scales an order of magnitude or so, which is predicted over the next two decades or so, we will need a very different HVAC system as well. So those are a few areas that are just on my mind right now.
I think those are enough areas for now, enough areas to dive deep on. George, thank you so much for taking the time. Love the conversation with you. And I think we'll end it here. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Pascal. It's been a pleasure.